and women and Jesus. I said, of course, Ronnie, that's a really easy request. Of course I could do that. And then, you know, start framing up. I said, oh, this is part of a bigger series, but I'm still good with it. So anyway, what I'm going to do is maybe a little bit different. I am going to start off with a couple of passages from Jesus and interactions with women. There's a lot of interactions with women with Jesus, right? I think everybody knows Jesus was very favorable towards women. I'm going to go through a handful, but the bulk of what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell a little bit about my own story, things that have happened to me through growing up, and as I got older, really some struggles I went through and some questions I struggled with. That's how we'll walk through. So the bulk of this is going to be more of a personal story. I will say I did some dry runs on the timing. Usually when I'm going through a class, I like to facilitate a lot and a lot of back and forth. I won't have time. If I start doing that, I won't finish. So because it is one long train of thought, it is one long story, I ask maybe you hold your questions and maybe talk to me afterwards because I basically won't be able to finish if I start filling a bunch of questions. And it is just a personal story anyway, more than anything else. So that's how we'll go through it. And hopefully it's beneficial for someone because this is spanning, you know, it's difficult within 40 minutes to span 6 years of somebody's life and insights, but I'm going to try to do that, right? But it obviously won't be adequate. All right, so starting off, I do want to go through a few passages just to frame some stuff up and maybe some insights that I didn't originally have growing up. So I did grow up in a Church of Christ. I grew up in Arkansas, very, very conservative Church of Christ, and we'll get into a little bit about that later. But I want to start off with a very well-known story, Mary and Martha, Luke chapter 10, verse 38, and then I'm going to jump over into John, where I'm going to go through some continuation with them. So Mary and Martha, in verse 38, that starts off, while they were traveling, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister named Mary, who also sat at the Lord's feet and was listening to what he said. Stopping right there, as I've gotten older and trying to dive more into what the Bible means and how to apply it, I was listening to a pastor talk, and he said when he was a young pastor, he was giving multiple sermons, and there was a Jewish individual, a Jewish Christian, in his congregation, and every Sunday he came up and said, "You're missing the point of what that passage is telling you, because you're not taking it into a Jewish context." So one interesting thing here is sitting at the Lord's feet, sitting at somebody's feet. When you use that term in the first century, that is a term used for somebody who's a disciple. So in this, the posture that Mary's taking on in here is that of a disciple. Which I don't think is surprising. I think we know that Jesus had multiple disciples, men and women. But Martha was distracted by her many tasks, and she came up and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to serve alone? So tell her to give me a hand." The Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has made the right choice, and it will not be taken away from her." So a couple of bullet points on what a disciple would have been doing in the first century. They typically memorized the teacher's words. They adopted the teacher's interpretation of scripture, emulated the teacher's ministry model, and typically used those teachings and made disciples of their own. I have heard some people try to use this and say this shows that Jesus was good with Mary being a disciple. A few caveats: it was not completely unheard of for a woman to sit in the position of a disciple. It was rare, but not unheard of. So this is by no means the only time something like that would happen. And it also wasn't required that everybody who sat as a disciple turn around and became a teacher. It was also typical that they would, but not always. So you can kind of take either side of that argument, and it's not just completely solid one side or the other. But what's important is that Mary was sitting in the posture of a disciple. It's not a Bible study. I always grew up thinking that, oh, this is really sweet. She wanted to be a part of a Bible study instead of cook. So the only point I'm trying to make is it's more than just a simple Bible study. All right, jumping over to John. I want to pick up on a couple more things with Mary and Martha. So in John 11, 28, this is when Lazarus dies, and Jesus goes, and Martha had just finished coming out and talking to Jesus about, why weren't you here? And they interact some. And then 28, we pick back up. And having said this, she went back, so she being Martha in this case, went back and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." As soon as Mary heard this, she got up and quickly went to him. Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw that Mary got up quickly and went out. So they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to cry there. As soon as Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her crying and the Jews who had come with her crying, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you put him?" he asked. "Lord," they told him, "come and see." So I'm going to stop there. And then I'm going to jump over just one page over in my book, but in chapter 12. You pick back up chapter 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, the one Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. Martha was serving them, and Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of perfume, pure and expensive nard, anointed Jesus' feet, and wiped his feet with her hair. So the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Then one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was about to betray him, said, "Why wasn't this perfume sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He didn't say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and he was in charge of the money bag and was still part of what was put in it. Jesus answered, "Leave her alone. She has kept it for the day of my burial, for you always will have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." So just stopping there, those are three key interactions, I think, between Jesus and Mary. And what I never appreciated was that relationship. When you see a lot of Jesus' relationships and him talking with apostles, you know, a lot of times Jesus is interacting with apostles, and he's almost like, "Come on, guys, this is what I'm trying to do." And the apostles don't always seem to be picking up on it, right? That's part of the interesting interaction that Jesus has. What I didn't appreciate really growing up and was never highlighted was, this is just a very important relationship. Mary seems to get Jesus in a way that not everybody does, and she's constantly inserting herself in a position that people don't like. People are not happy about, or at least a few people, are not happy about her sitting at Jesus' feet, Martha very specifically, and then Judas in this one, and there may have been others, but in general, she's putting herself in positions that people are like, what is she doing? Why is she doing that? And somehow saying she's out of place. So I'm not going to take that thread any further than that. I'm not going to draw this to, I'm really not going to try to land a whole bunch of nailed conclusions. I'm just going to make statements that kind of cause me to pause and reflect a little bit, all right? All right, so one other passage that I want to get to with Jesus and some interactions with women goes over into Luke 24, verse 1. And this is maybe, if you will, one of the pinnacles of the Bible, right? This is the resurrection. This is Easter Sunday. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they came to the tomb bringing the spices they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. They went in but did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men stood by them in dazzling clothes. So the women were terrified and bowed down to the ground. "Why are you looking for the living among the dead?" asked the men. "He is not here, but he has risen. Remember how he spoke to you when he was still in Galilee, saying, 'It's necessary that the Son of Man be betrayed into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, and rise on the third day?'" And they remembered his words. Returning to the tomb, from the tomb, they reported all these things to the 11, to all of the rest. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of Jesus, and the other women that were with them were telling the apostles about these things. But these words seemed like nonsense to them, and they did not believe the women. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. When he stooped to look in, he saw only the linen clothes. So he went away amazed at what happened. When you ever dive into first century culture and the reliability of the text behind the Gospels, one of the things they point out is that if you were trying to fake something, you would not have said in the first century that women were the first ones to see Jesus rise and women brought the message to the disciples. You would put that on a man. Women weren't considered highly credible, and there were a lot of issues with a woman being able to be the person to pass them along. You know, most people have probably heard, you know, they didn't testify in court, stuff like that. So just reflecting on it, it's interesting that the women were chosen. It's also interesting that the apostles didn't believe them. You know, so that's just something where you kind of take in. It's an interesting way to bring the story about in this way, in that you've got women bringing the story to apostles, apostles not believing. Peter, I guess, at least had enough sense to get up and go and expect for himself. And that's just a couple of the passages. So you could go on for, you know, you could turn this series into a year just going through and diving into these different passages. But I want to stop there because I'm just going to throw a few things out. And I want to transition a little bit more into my personal story, my background. So like I said, I grew up in a very conservative church, Church of Christ in Arkansas. I won't say the name because I don't know if this is going to be recorded. But But basically, it was a very, you know, I don't know what everybody's experience in here were like, but the way that I kind of saw Christianity was it was a checklist model, and the goal of being a good Christian is to complete the checklist. When you miss something, ask for forgiveness and repeat, right? And so I really saw Christianity as a set of rules. They were relatively black and white, and that was the model we had, and that was the model that I thought the Bible taught. I will say that was not an overly positive experience. I won't get into a lot of that, but in general, growing up in this textbook model where there's just a set of rules and you're just following a checklist every day didn't really come across in a very positive way. So I would grow up, I'd get older. I moved down to, in my mid-20s, I moved to New Orleans, and I went to, started going to Carrollton Avenue Church of Christ, New Orleans. So I will say their name, because I have positive things to say about them. But when I went to Carrollton, it was different. So growing up in the church I grew up in, most of our lessons were from Paul's letters or James or Peter and the Old Testament. We didn't spend a lot of time in the gospel. You know, Jesus was there. You had the resurrection on the cross. But we didn't tend to dive very deep into the gospel teachings of Jesus because we got the really solid stuff from Paul. Right, we got some really concrete stuff from Paul that we were able to apply, and Peter and James. So when I went to Carrollton, it was very different because they almost only talked about Jesus. So Carrollton's in an urban area. It's not a very wealthy church. I think it's okay to say that. And it's in the middle of New Orleans, right? So they were primarily talking about Jesus, and that was very different to me. And I thought, well, this is interesting. This is kind of a flavor that I hadn't seen before, and it really did have a big impact on me, and it changed the way that I saw church and Christianity and spirituality in a positive way. So I would continue going there. I got married to my wife, Jennifer. She started going there with me. We had our first son, and eventually I got an opportunity to move to Houston with work. So we moved. Now, during this time period, I'd always told Jennifer, I said, you know, I'm not tied to like a church's name. It's more about what the church is teaching, about the people. So I always said, I'm not just locked into always attending a church with the Church of Christ on it. So we moved to Houston. We started trying a lot of different churches, but we landed at a Church of Christ on the west side of Houston. And something became clear to me that made me a little nervous, kind of scared me. The fact of the matter was I was tied to the Church of Christ name. So I said, yeah, I don't see musical instruments. I kind of see that's probably not foundational. I can see that's not necessarily something you have to have. But at the end of the day, I did not want to attend a church with musical instruments. I didn't like it. Little things here and there, but when it came down to it, if it wasn't something that was very consistent with how I was raised, I absolutely didn't like it, and I couldn't convince myself to do it. So that scared me because I didn't see myself as that person. I saw myself as a pretty open person, somebody who took in all the data, took in all the different choices and really assessed it. And I realized that may not be who I am. And what really shook me up about that was when I reflected on... Now the church in Houston was a pretty decent church too. It wasn't necessarily like how I was raised, but it scared me in that if that's the mental model I was locked in at, I didn't want to end up... you know, just I didn't want to raise my kids in the type of environment that I was raised in, from a Church of Christ, from a church aspect, because I was afraid they'd walk away. A lot of people I knew who were raised in those environments did not stick around, and I could see that. It was a very, you know, it wasn't a very encouraging version of Christianity. And so when I reflected on how am I going to raise my kids and what am I going to stress to them, I had to ask myself, how well do I know the Bible? And for me, I knew a lot of arguments. I knew a lot of what I was taught. I could really argue with somebody of another denomination, and I could stand my ground. But when I reflected, I mainly knew what I was told by other people, and I knew arguments. And when I really reflected on it, when I've engaged with people in the past, I wasn't really engaging with them. I was waiting for them to quit talking so I could prove them wrong. And when I reflected on that, it was surprising. And so what I ultimately decided to do was something that was relatively difficult. And I said, well, I'm going to open the Bible. I'm going to read it from front to back. I've usually read passages here, passages there. I think most people have typically done that. But I'm going to try my hardest to walk in with a clean slate. I'm going to try my hardest, as much as a person can try, to erase my mind of what I believe the Bible says, and I'm going to walk in with a fresh set of eyes and pretend if I'd never seen this before, what would I take? And so I did that. Took a while, but it was eye-opening. It was not what I expected to run into. And I'm surprised because, you know, at this point I was like, now this isn't that long ago. This is like 2013, right? So I'm 38, so I'm well in my 30s. So this isn't like an exercise I did at 21. I was very surprised about what I saw. And a few of the big insights that jump out, and this is when I got done with the book of Acts. A few things that really jumped out at me was that there wasn't a whole lot that I was seeing at that point about corporate worship, which growing up was like a main focus area. We really argued over why the Church of Christ did these things on Sunday mornings, and this is how you have to do it. And I didn't see a lot of that, and I was looking for that. I actually thought that I was going to find quite a bit of that. Jesus is very concerned about how we treat others, especially the disadvantaged. The ways that I, and this got to me, even the ways I went past homeless individuals in my car on off-ramps changed that point, because just the repeated message. So I saw these big themes out there, not like one sentence, but I saw these big themes that were starting to strike me in a way that hadn't previously. And last on these bullet points that I had kind of landed on was Jesus seemed to get really upset at groups of people who blindly followed rules that hurt others. That's the Pharisees, right? When I was growing up and I read all these stories, I always saw myself on Jesus' side. It's like, yeah, those Pharisees, I would have done the same thing. Those people, they don't know what they're doing. But when I read through this, I paused. I was like, you know, when I really dive into this, I'm not so sure that I'm not on the Pharisee side of this equation. And maybe that, I'm not sure how many people see that. Because I see myself right where the Pharisees are, right? Like, they've got a solid argument on most of what they do, right? If you just took in and said, hey, we think we should do this because of this, it's there. Jesus seems to be more focused on the intent of the rule, though. And so he constantly says, that's, you know, you go through the Sabbath, you go through many of the different things that they got into. He was always focused on, well, that may be what it says in that case, but the intent of the rule is this, and so this is how you apply consistently. And that was pretty surprising to me, too. I actually think I may have even, at some point on the phone, talked to my parents. I was like, have y'all really looked at these Pharisee situations? You know, this is a little bit shaking. But then I continued through the rest of the letters from Paul, the rest of the letters from Peter, James, everybody else. And I started running into things that I couldn't really tie together. Started running to, you know, because there's very specific things when you get in those letters, and I was struggling to really tie together in a consistent way. And that was just a mental struggle I was having. Not saying right or wrong, but I was having a hard time dealing with how to tie all this together because I had very specific things here and put in my context in America in the 21st century, I was struggling with how to make that really consistent with what I was seeing out of Jesus. And I probably struggled with that for about 2 years. I read a lot. I reached out to a lot of different things. I eventually, you know, discovered podcasts, which are really cool. And I kept on diving into it, and I really didn't make a lot of ground. I was diving into it deeper and deeper, and I wasn't overly successful at some of the stuff I was dealing with. But then something happened. I won't get into kind of the flip of what kind of happened, but then I would say I got the big picture in a way I hadn't previously. And without going, I can't really go through all the stuff that kind of caused me to have that, because we don't have time. But once I believed that, okay, I think I'm pulling it together, here are the things that kind of insights I had from pulling it together that helped me understand what I wasn't seeing previously. And it was that Jesus is focused on the intent. He was always focused on the intent. You don't have a lot of, like, you know, you got very specific things with Paul. Jesus is specific, but he's very intent-focused. And Jesus was very much about the why. Not as much the what, but that's what all of his arguments with Pharisees and stuff, and when you get into the Sabbath, and even when you get into the Sermon on the Mount, the first time I heard that, I thought, oh my goodness, Jesus is just making all the rules more strict. That's not what he's doing, though. He's explaining, you're missing the intent of the rule. The rule says, don't commit adultery. You don't even think about it, right? So the rule isn't, because people can slide in and out of rules. When you have black and white rules, you can find loopholes. You know, a lot of people are in, you know, that's what we do with rules. We find loopholes. And so one big bullet was Jesus is focused on the why. And the letters, and once I really understood that, what I saw was the letters were examples of early Christians implementing the why in different situations. Because ultimately, you got to have a what somewhere. You need a what in the how. You can't only function on whys. And so what I realized I was seeing was Paul was taking the why, and he was turning it into the what and the how in a way that a group of people could actually implement it in a way that was beneficial. And once I understood that, I quit being, so I lost my heartburn about Paul. I saw, okay, there's no inconsistency here. These are how Paul was turning the whys into real tangible things. And also the last bullet that I'll say is I learned, I was struggling from knowledge. I thought my answers were a knowledge gap. It wasn't a knowledge gap. You know, faith is about trust and wisdom, and the Bible's about wisdom. So that's the last thing I'll say was knowledge wasn't winning the argument for me. So at that point, I want to say something that I would say is one of the bigger insights I've had. And I've heard it talked about in multiple settings. So I would read different things, and people will say, well, this statement's a cultural thing, right? So they say, you don't have to apply this because it's cultural. I want to give my opinion on this. I would say that, yeah, everything's a cultural statement, everything's spiritual, but I don't think it's valid to say, I found this thing in the Bible, and that's cultural, so I'm going to slide it away. I know that maybe go a little different on some of the stuff we're talking about, but if I say, well, you know, this sentence is cultural, so you don't have to apply it. I can't deal with that, right? Because I don't know how to manage that. I don't have a good logic for moving some things out, but keeping some things based on what I think culture is. What I will say is, everything is about the why. And so when I find a statement that I say, that's cultural, we don't do that today, because there's a lot of things that are culture that we don't do, right? The question isn't, do I apply it or do I throw it out? The question is, why did the writer say that? What's the writer trying to get at? Because maybe the what looks different here than here, but the why should be the same. So it's always about the why. So when we've gone through things, and I know there's a little bit in some of the texts we're going through outside of Sunday morning, talk about cultural, I just don't think that's relevant. I think it's about the why. And so let me give an example with this. 1 Timothy 2:9, you know, people like to point at this as a cultural thing. Also, the women are to dress themselves in modest clothing with decency and good sense, not with elaborate hairstyles, gold, pearls, or expensive apparel. So I'm just looking around right now. I don't know if we're applying this today. But let's think about the why a little bit. Why would Paul have said that in the context of Timothy? And I'm not diving into the whole book of Timothy. So I want to go back to when I was at Carrollton. Like I said, Carrollton was a more of an urban setting. And when I started going to Carrollton, I dressed the way I've always dressed. Khakis, button-up shirt, tie, maybe a sports coat, depends on how hot it was. And I did that for a while, and I started looking around at the other members of the church, and I realized a large percentage of those individuals probably are living below the poverty line, and they weren't able to dress like that. And the more I looked around, the more uncomfortable I got with my attire. And I felt like I was calling out my socioeconomic status in a way that wasn't beneficial to the other people there. And I felt like it was potentially something that was maybe separating me a little bit. And that's not ultimately what I wanted to do. And so I reflected, yeah, God, you know, we do say in the Bible, you bring your best to the Lord, but I wasn't sure in that situation if that meant I needed to wear my $100 suits. And so I stopped doing that. I said, I don't like this atmosphere I'm creating. And so I started, not just in fully down, but maybe more like this. And I still do that, just because that's how that's just something I've stuck with. So I started wearing jeans instead. I felt like in that, Paul's talking about, don't separate yourself. You know, you got to tell a lot of these things with people eating at different tables, people with money, people not with money. I felt like Paul's saying, we're all brothers in Christ. We're all sisters in Christ. Don't allow your earthly goods, your status, your career, your status in the community, that shouldn't be something that separates you. And so what I took from that was, well, that's the why. Maybe in one atmosphere, in one setting, it's applied one way. I'll tell you when I go back to other churches, maybe back with family in Arkansas, Most people do dress up. And if I was to walk in wearing maybe this, they would be very confused on why I'm not dressed up. So in that situation, I do dress up differently. So it's not always applied the same way in every circumstance. But it is always about the why and what's the spiritual significance of why this statement is being made. So that's my opinion about throwing something out because it's not culturally relevant. I say don't do that. Ask why is the writer saying that. And then take that and expand on it. Let's see how much time I have. So I'm going to keep on moving because I'm running short. So I'm going to dive into a few things with women. And even going through these journeys, I would actually say I went through this journey of changing the way that I viewed a lot of things in the Bible. The question about women's roles really didn't pop up very quickly. I never really heard anybody complain about women's roles. If somebody did feel like they were didn't like how it was being handled, nobody ever said it, especially when I was growing up. I would say the thing that made me think a little bit differently about women's roles was having a daughter. So Ella, my daughter's 3. Andrew, 7. Lucas, 5. So when I started watching Ella grow up and watching her, I started thinking, what is it about her that's spiritually different than my boys? I know outside of the church, if she's gifted as a leader or as a teacher, she can do that. I know that. I know a lot of women who are better leaders than men in workplace settings, a lot of them. So I just sit there and reflect on, why does God see my daughter Ella different than my sons and Andrew and Luke in a spiritual setting? So that's the question I asked. Well, once again, rhetorical questions, not looking for them to be answered. These are just things I kind of soaked on. Couple of things to go through. If you've never, this is a book by a woman named Sarah Barton. She works at Pepperdine. She grew up Church of Christ, went to school at Harding. She's been a missionary with her husband, John Barton. A very good book. This explains a little bit. So she grew up in a Church of Christ that she was told she couldn't teach, but when she got older, she felt like she had the gift of teaching. So this is just her personal story. I do encourage you if you've kind of struggled with so a lot of the stuff I've read wasn't overly convincing to me with my Church of Christ background. I felt like they were allowing emotions to play a part into it a little bit more, and so I would read through stuff and say, yeah, that's not very solid. This is not an argument. This is a story. So I do encourage you, if you can, this is a good book to read. But Sarah tells a story in here. So Sarah's from Arkansas. You know, she's probably a Razorback fan like me. We're struggling right now, so she and I could probably relate with this. We did have a really good weekend. We had a good day yesterday, though. Arkansas had a really good day yesterday. We had a bye week. So we're trying to load up the bye weeks. It's probably the most effective way not to have double-digit losses. Sarah tells a story when she's in Africa with her husband, John. And they're spread thin. I've never been a missionary. I don't really feel call for that. I don't think I would be good at that. But they're spread thin, and she's working with some individuals, with some men in Africa, and they decide they want to get baptized. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure who baptized them. I don't remember that. But they get baptized, and then Sarah tells them, well, I can't teach you anymore. And they say, well, why? And she walks them through the Bible, through the scriptures, and says, you know, the position of my church is that you're a baptized male, and I cannot teach you. And they said, no. They said, your husband's doing other things. They're spread thin. They're doing lots of stuff. They said, you have what we need, Sarah. I want you to teach us. And she says, yeah, I can't do that. I even lose my funding. If the church that sent me here finds out that I'm teaching baptized men, they'll probably cut us off. So ultimately, she goes through that story and how she handled it. But the men were very upset. And they said, you can't do this to us. You brought us this far. We bought in. And now you're cutting us off. So that story's in this book. So you may say, okay, that's a missionary story, though. Those are on the extremes. So here's another just question I ask myself. So I've never read a Beth Moore book, but I hear from a lot of people that she's a very good teacher. And so a question I've reflected on when it comes to women teaching a man, I do know people who have gone to Beth Moore seminars, you know, including men. And the feedback from a lot of them is that the material she presents makes them a better husband, makes them a better father, and draws them closer to God. And so I ask myself a question, is that sin because she's teaching a baptized man? And you say, well, is it a Sunday morning or not Sunday morning? Well, you know, even if it is on Sunday morning, if she's providing information that was needed, much like Sarah in Africa, and giving a baptized man insights, I think that is teaching, right? If I'm learning something from you, and you're giving me something I didn't have, I think that is teaching. So what does that mean? And lastly, so I know in a small rural church, it's a very small church that I know of. I won't get into the specifics of it, but very, very small church. Probably the church, like the people in this room right here would be a big, big audience for that church. So the typical church size is probably half the room. But it's been around for a long time, and the people who go there need it. Very rural area. There's a couple of women that really hold that church together. The church has no official elders. But the couple of women hold it together. I would definitely say, even when it comes down to helping procure preachers and teachers and setting stuff up, they're the people who do it, because the men, there are some men there. The men are not gifted in that sense, or don't desire to do it. And I was talking to somebody at that church, and I said, well, you know, these two women, I'm going to say Jane and I'm going to say Jane, right, for the story. I said, you know, Jane is, she's kind of the leader of your church, isn't she? And they said, no, that would be a sin. Jane is not an elder. I said, how do you know who the leader is? Because typically, the person people follow is the leader, no matter what name you put on them. I said, Jane's leading you. They said, yeah, but she's not an elder. Very clear, she's not the leader. So I just kind of reflect on that too. How do you know who the leader is? Probably the person you're following. All right. So I tell those stories just, and I'm not trying to give an answer. I've kind of dealt with this for 2013 is really when I started diving into this and trying to say, what does this mean to me? And trying to understand how to apply. And applying the why has really helped me a lot. And that's helped me even on this, the stuff like we've gone through with the blue parakeet, on how I understand what God needs me to do. Because what God needs us to do here, and say I go to Pakistan, are very different, right? So there's stuff that I would do in America that went, even in my clothing in Pakistan would be very different, right? So if I keep that why behind, the intent of what's the spiritual significance, that helps me. One more story before I try to close it out. I am going to try to close it out before we get close to the bells. I was reading, so we get bookmarks in King's Quarters. Love the bookmarks. It gives a very good plan for reading with the Bible with the kids. I was sitting down early on. Andrew was probably six or so, and we were reading through a bookmark, and it was about gossiping, about not gossiping. But the bookmark was the passages we were reading were very specific, saying, if somebody gives you a secret and tells you not to tell, do not tell. Paraphrasing, right? It's very specific about not telling other people's stories, not telling other people's secrets. And I read through that with Andrew, and we get done with it. And I think to myself, you know, going through a lot of training with, you know, children, child workers, and you think, well, there's a potential that would not be good. Because when you get into child abuse, that's what people who are abusing child tell them to do, keep a secret. So I sat down there with Andrew, so I thought, how am I going to handle this? So I said, well, Andrew, let me ask you a question. When you read something in the Bible and you read a sentence, do you take that and you just always apply without thinking about it? And Andrew looked at me. He stared at me for a while because he figured I was testing them in a way. He's like, we're going to see what happens here. He looked at me and said, no. And I was a little surprised. I was like, no. Well, what? And so we talked through a little bit, and we said, the Bible is a wonderful tool for wisdom. You have to understand why the writer wrote that so you don't misapply it. So we started talking about how to apply things when you run into it. And he probably quit listening to me at that point. He was only six. But so it's probably me more talking to myself. But trying to talk through this thing about how to understand what God's calling you to do. And I said, really, for me, focusing on the Jesus. If I want to wrap up how I look at the Bible, I try to start with Jesus. I think that kind of makes sense, but that's not the way my brain does not default to that. I'll be very, very clear. The way you're raised and the way that you're initially taught is imprinted in your brain. That's it's it's hard to reset a default setting. But when I run into a problem and I really even reflect on my behavior, I look at the stories of Jesus and I look at the way that Jesus interacted with the Pharisees, interacted with the disadvantaged, interacted with women, and what I enjoy doing is also even understanding on a first century context. That's sometimes difficult to do. You know, having three kids, I don't have a whole lot of free time, which is why I love podcasts. But I reflect on what that means. So I'm going to close out with a general statement, and most of this has just been a story. It hasn't had a lot of opinion. I'm going to close out with a couple of statements. I am going to work a bit of an opinion in here, so this is where you'll get mad if you get mad anywhere. This is my opinion, too. So take anything with a grain of salt, right? I'm just trying to share with you a little bit of where I've landed. I'm not necessarily telling you that I'm right and anybody else is wrong. I'm just saying what I've landed on. So I'm going to start with my intention. Ultimately, my intention is always to follow God with all my ability, which means constantly trying to love my neighbor, love my enemy, and God. If I make a mistake while I'm doing that because I misinterpreted something, and I could, but I erred on the side of trying to bring more people to God, I have no concern about where my salvation stands with God. That's the type of mistakes that I will be okay making. I think God expects some mistakes. Moving in a position you can't do in a 40-minute discussion, and it's really hard to do just in a small series. I will say over 6 years, I would say that when I take the gospel, Acts, and Paul's letters into full account, and I put it all together, and we talk about that with baptism, right? We say if you look at the whole picture of the Bible, you can't take one thing like the baptism out of context. And we do that a lot when we're talking about the plan for salvation. We say you got to take the full thing into account. I would say when I take everything into account, I see a lot of evidence that women were not only not prohibited from teaching and leading, but that they were a very active part of the early church leadership. I think Romans 16 provides strong evidence on that. I would say that evidence is not trumped by a couple of sentences written by the same writer who appears to be using women as teachers and leaders in his ministry. Took me a lot of time to form that, so I would not expect many, if most people, to necessarily share that. In Timothy, yeah.
And in 1 Corinthians.
Yep. So, and that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying is grabbing those small statements makes me ask more about why was he saying that.
I would love then, to teach a little bit about why he says that, but they won't let
And tie, well, that's good. That's good. Well,
that, all right.
So tying in, especially Romans, especially the Gospels, when you take that whole mountain, I see something different there than maybe what I was taught.
I would like to hear the other side, too.
Yep. Well, maybe that's something for a future discussion. All right, well, hold on a second. Hold on a second. Let me wrap up. I'm almost there. The last thing I want to say is when you start talking about faith, so faith is about trust, and none of us have everything figured out. We don't. A lot of times we like to think we do, but we don't. Working together, especially on stuff about this, is not about winning an argument. It's more about listening. And I want to embarrass somebody really quick because I think they do a good job at this. Now, I probably got a lot of people wondering who I'm going to talk about. So Brian Anderson, he may be upstairs. He didn't know I was going to say this. That's really the way I like to interact with people. Brian Anderson have a handful of things after a Bible study or after a life group. He and I didn't agree on it. But we sat there and we talked about it afterwards. And every time I walk away from that discussion, I think Brian was actually listening to me. He wasn't just arguing to try to win an argument. He was actually trying to dive a little bit deeper and to understand why. So you've said something that I didn't expect. Why did you say that? I'm actually interested in hearing it. And I don't know a lot of Brian Andersons out there. That's why I'm using him as an example. But I walk away wanting to do the same thing. I'm like, well, if he's going to listen to me, I should listen to him. And I think in reality, both people move a little bit. Because none of us are absolutely 100% right on everything. So this is a difficult thing to go through. There's a difficult discussion, a lot of passion around this. What I would say is listening is important. Understanding you're not the smartest person in the room is always important. And faith is about trust. And, you know, families argue. Families disagree. My family disagrees and argues. Because you're arguing and disagreeing doesn't mean you're not a family. That just means you're normal. And without that, I think families that don't argue, don't discuss things openly, either harbor things in or they don't ever even grow together. They don't mature. So that's where I land at. I'm going to say a prayer and close. Thank you for listening. Thank you for not throwing anything at me. It was very, very, very gracious. Dear God, we thank you for this time that you have given us to come together. We thank you for this community. God, I especially thank you for the community at South and for the things it's done for me in my life and my family's life. I pray to you that you'll walk with us and just keep us open to each other, keep us open to you, most importantly, and help us learn what you need us to learn and interact with us, with each other, and follow your word to your true intent. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.